Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey, everybody, this is Angela Orkin, and thank you all for listening. I'm really excited today to have two guests, and we are going to talk about an incredible new resource that is out there. It is the Safe Havens 2 report. And I would like to first introduce our guests. First up, we have Emilio Valladolid. Welcome, Emilio. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes. Hi, I'm Emilio Valladolid. I use they, them pronouns, A in Spanish, and I'm a youth contributor in the Safe Havens report.
Excellent. Welcome. And also would like to welcome Elliot Hinkle. Elliot, thank you for joining us today. And can you just do a quick introduction for us?
Yeah, I'm Elliot Hinkle. I use they, them pronouns. I'm the principal and founder of Unicorn Solutions and one of the co-authors of the Safe Havens 2 report. And excited to be here with you all today.
Excellent. Well, just to get things going, this is the second version of the Safe Havens report. And there have been some really great updates. And I'm going to kick it over to Elliot to kind of just give us a summary of that to start off. And then we'll move on to some more specific elements of the report and some tips for lawyers.
Yeah, so this report is a follow-up on a 2017 version of Safe Havens. And that report really highlighted some key findings of overrepresentation in systems, so really giving folks an understanding of LGBTQ youth in child welfare and juvenile justice systems. It also covered the lack of explicit protections that existed then, as well as what are some recommendations of reform. And so in the updated report in 2024, we really wanted to make sure to bring lived experience voice much more clearly in this report. And so in the prior report, youth were consulted, but they didn't have their names listed and really sort of were hidden for their protection. But with this report, as long as the youth contributors were comfortable, we wanted them to have their voices clear and their name attached to it. So there's our youth contributors who really helped inform and sort of drive the thinking of this report. So since the 2017 report, what sort of occurred? So really lay of the landscape of that. There's a much greater focus on non-binary youth as that population has grown both in our collective knowing and understanding, but also in some of the policies and laws that have come to exist. But what this report also shows is that there's still a lot of work to be done, even though there's been an increase in research and policy. And then last, what makes this report so functionally tool helpful is that there's an accountability section. And so when folks look at the website, obviously we can't show them in this audio. When you go to the report and you go to safehavensreport.com or .org, it's going to reload to a Lambda Legal webpage. And on that webpage, there's two buttons in the middle. So you can watch the 2024 Youth Contributor videos, which is one of those that Emilio's in. And then we've also got the 2024 report itself. And it's a webpage. And when you get there and you think that you're just seeing like some sections, but you're not seeing much text, you just want to press the little plus signs as you go down the page. It's going to expand the sections and you're going to find all the report writing. And when you get lower in the report, there's a section about accountability. And what we did is we took and found every grievance procedure we could find or ombudsperson. So if you're looking for the child welfare or juvenile justice accountability process, if we could find it, we listed it there. So if you're working with young people today, right now, that may be a tool to bookmark for yourself so that when you have an issue come up, you can direct young people right there.
That's a great resource. And I appreciate you walking through kind of how to navigate the report because it is a different format. I love it. I think you know, it's interactive. It is, you know, being able to watch the videos alongside the writing, I think is really powerful. So it's very well done. And I encourage people to click around and read and watch and learn from it. With that, I would love to shift to you, Emilio, and maybe could you just tell us a little bit about how this process of creating the report and doing the videos was for you and, you know, kind of what your takeaways were from it?
Yeah, totally. So for me, the report, you know, of course, was really important to be able to tell part of my story and part of the reasons why I thought it was so vital to share this information. Recording those videos was definitely something that I was new at and I found to be even like transformational for me. It was definitely a moment to share my story in a way that I felt was impactful and was gonna help inform people who who might not know how to handle this topic or how to interact with trans and non-binary youth and how to really help us in ways that will, like I said, be transformational.
Yeah. Well, and I would say to you how much we appreciate your courage in doing the videos. We do podcasts all the time and we've been playing around with video and it is a very different experience and it takes a lot of courage, but it makes it so much more personal and relatable for people. And so thank you for being willing to do it. I think it does make the report something really special.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And so one other thing I just wanted to point out and see if either of you had anything additional to say, the call to action seems like a really good place for lawyers to start in terms of the key elements. Are there any particular parts of that? If a lawyer was just going to start, you know, their first plus sign that they would click on, would you point them to anything particular in the call to action? It's all helpful, but.
Yeah. The call to action is close to the top of the report page, and it's got four sections. There's respect all youth's identity and expression, invest in families, not institutions, connect youth to support an LGBTQ+ community, and ensure youth receive mental health and medical care from qualified providers. It is very hard to pick which one to prioritize. Okay. I would, of course, read them all, but I do think respecting all youth's identity and expression does sort of, in summary, cover everything, which is that young people should be able to be who they are. They shouldn't have fear of judgment, retaliation, lack of services. They should have quality mental and physical health care, again, without any concern of it being with prejudice. And that to know your identity and to know yourself and express it, you're going to need community and you're going to need places to see yourself represented and to feel safe in that. And I think Emilio's interview kind of highlights that being able to go to the local LGBTQ center was helpful and was supportive. And so, and other youth had mentioned this as well. So I think thinking about what are the ways that we help young people know that it's okay to be themselves, but also have their back when things were hard, because that is how we sort of get to know ourselves. There's a quote I love that says, like, the death of identity is the death of self. And so if we don't let young people know who they are and experience that and explore that, they're not going to get to be their full actualized self. And I think that is sad to me. So I want to make sure that young people have that.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that we will link to in the show notes is the CenterLink LGBTQ Center Association, which has, so wherever you are, you can click on that and see if there is a center that you could connect your clients with. In this instance, Emilio, I know this was a really important part for you. Would you want to add anything in terms of connecting to a community?
Yeah, definitely. I think connecting to community is one of the things that essentially saved my life. It was definitely something that showed me not only was I not alone, but there was different things to explore and different aspects of my life that I could really look at and investigate in a way that was like fruitful for me. So I think that is important. And I also think we kind of mentioned it, but that looking at the identity that we hold and also looking at the whole person that we are is so important. And it's just such a beautiful process and such a beautiful journey. And it really helps, at least for me, it helped my mental health. It helped me be the person that I am today.
Thank you. That's helpful. And I just want to, we're kind of shifting here from the report into, you know, clear suggestions for you lawyers out there. And I think one of the things I just want to make sure we get across is how that you can play a role in helping your clients identify these resources. And we will provide that link for you so that it's easy. But I do want to shift into the beginning of the attorney-client relationship and talking about how important it is to build a solid relationship with your client. And I think one of the things that I have heard again and again from lawyers is a fear of saying the wrong thing, asking the wrong question, using the wrong terminology, acronyms, those types of things. And so I know that, Emilio, you had some thoughts on this and some advice for lawyers in terms of those fears. What would you say to a lawyer who is just going to meet with a new client and how to kind of get over that fear of getting it wrong?
Yeah, of course. I think I even experienced it myself just having people nervous to ask questions, nervous to kind of prod too hard. Mm-hmm. But I think it's incredibly crucial to not avoid these questions and to really, like I said, get to know the whole person, which being trans or non-binary is part of that whole person. And so I think it's important not to be afraid to ask questions and not to be afraid to make mistakes. Of course, we want to be respectful, we want to be sensitive to sensitive topics, but it's not 100% foolproof that even I will get things correctly. And I've been in the LGBT community, surrounded by the LGBT community for years of my life. So I think it's really a powerful tool to be curious and to be willing to learn and willing to invest in that person. And as a lawyer, I think it's important to be able to understand who you're fighting for and who, what part of their identity is important to their case.
Thank you. Yeah, and I do want to say it is, of course, incumbent upon us as lawyers to learn and to be on top of what's out there. And on that note, we will reference a glossary that is also referenced in the report by the Center for the Study of Social Policy. So if you're really new to learning some of the language, this is a really good place to be. But I think one of the points that you have made, and I'd love to hear, Elliot, from you on this, is really the is that the best practice is honoring the language that the individuals use themselves to describe themselves. Can you talk to us a little more about that?
Yeah. So I think we could get hung up on knowing the terms, knowing what all of them mean, thinking that we have to know everything before we can do or act or whatever. The reality is that even for Emilio and myself, figuring out who we were was practice of our own terms that we wanted to use or what did our friends use and what's the right pronoun that feels good, let alone being around more and more queer people when you haven't been. You get better at it, but you only get better at it from practice. And that's true for most of life. And so being okay with the fact that you're going to get it wrong, as long as it's not, maliciously intended, that lack of intentionality is usually more harmful versus I'm really trying, I'm going to keep practicing. When I get it wrong, I'm going to apologize quickly and move on and not make it about myself and know that I'm not a failure, I'm working on it. And so that modeling that we can even do when we get it wrong and fail sort of gracefully will also model for other people to not make it such a big deal, but to keep trying. And I think it's really important that people operate with curiosity of like, you don't have to know all the answers. You can ask questions like, what does that term mean for you? How can I best support you with this? Again, not having to get caught up in, I need to know how to do and say the right thing and react well all the time. That's just life. We're humans. And I don't have that expectation of people. But you won't get better at it if you don't practice and try and if you avoid it. And I think it would be a disservice to clients to not be willing to be curious and to try. Because I feel like young people know when there's sort of bullshit afoot, right? And so they know when you're messing it up. And so I think just being willing to try and being authentic in that is far more worth it than this fear of getting it wrong. And I say that especially to attorneys who I'm sure like to be accurate and correct all the time. You are
Yes.
also still a human, and your young people will appreciate that sort of authenticity in your interactions with them.
It's funny because you read my mind, because I
Yeah.
think as lawyers in particular, particularly in the court context and everything, your whole, you have to present as knowing everything and knowing what's next, but that doesn't need to transfer into your client meetings and into, it is okay to be clear on what you know and what you don't know, and to ask questions. We are talking to an audience of people, myself, being one who really don't want to get anything wrong. And so we have to push through that discomfort and know that it's in the interest of our clients. We cannot do our job if we do not really understand who our clients are, what is important to them, what they need in the system in which we operate. And so it requires us to push through that discomfort. But I appreciate so much both of your words about it. It is an adjustment for folks, and I think this conversation will certainly help. I'd like to shift now, Emilio, to you and talking about the importance of youth voice, both in the direction of the case itself and then when the youth is interested in the court process. I'd like to hear from you a little more about why that's so important, and through your experience, the ability to as a youth in the system to be able to impact the outcome and feel empowered?
I think that lived experience, as someone with lived experience, is just so, such a core part of understanding what it's actually like to be in these systems and what it's like to want to make all these changes and not have the ability to. So as someone with lived experience, I think it's really been such an important journey for me to be able to come back and talk and to educate on what it was like to be in the system and also what it's like to be out of the system and the court processes and all that good stuff. So I think it's just important for so many reasons, but particularly because there's no good way to understand unless you hear from people with lived experience and know what they would have wanted to change and what they would have done if they had the opportunity to do, how they would have wanted to be fought for or cared about in a way that they weren't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ellie, did you want to add to that?
Yeah. Yeah, I was just going to add, another unique piece of this report is that the other three organizations that were doing this, so Lambda Legal, Children's Rights, and Center for the Study of Social Policy, they had worked together on the initial report in 2017, and they already all knew me and had at least understood, like, why would it be important to also partner with a person with lived experience to bring in the people with lived experience, to support them, to understand it. There's a nuance in what I understand from my lived experience and how I wanted to support Emilio and the six others and what I wanted them to be able to talk about and also feel comfortable that they didn't have to talk about. And so I think youth voice is important in so many aspects of the work that we do, or even lived experience voice, so that, again, this sort of, you don't have to know all the things, but there might be people who can help you partner and do the work as best as possible. And so I think that's why it's also important that we get comfortable with asking people with lived experience, like, do you want to help me with this thing? What do you think? Is this the best way to go about this? Is there anything we should change? Because they all had different recommendations, and plenty of them also aligned with each other, but they all have different recommendations. They have their own thoughts and opinions, but you're not going to know that if you're not willing to ask, even if you don't like what you hear or you don't agree with it. That, I think, is an important check for all of us to hear directly from the people most impacted. And so I think the seven young people who were youth contributors to this report really just highlight that it is absolutely possible to ask young folks, what do they think? What's important to them? What should change? And then to know that that's actionable as this report sort of structures it. There's both what they said, but then we just basically underscore that with research or policy and just say, yep, like that really is possible and you should do this. And so let it also be a model for you of like, what are the ways that you can operate best as an ally and in solidarity with young people impacted by systems by bolstering their voice, not speaking for them, but giving them an opportunity to really be heard is crucial.
Yeah, the field is getting much, much better about incorporating lived experience into high-level policy decisions. And this report is just an excellent example of how powerful it is. I do want to talk a little more on the case level, too, which, Ellie, you kind of shifted to. And Emilio, I'd love to hear a little of your experience on this. During the court process, as the case is ongoing, where do you think, and without calling anyone out, of course, but where do you think your lawyer could have empowered you more toward an outcome in the case that was best for you and that you wanted? Did you have opportunities to speak for yourself? Did you want the lawyer to do it? Like, maybe talk a little bit on the case level about the importance. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. For me, it was, I had a few different lawyers, and with each lawyer that I had, I think it would have been very beneficial to me to have some more information just right off the bat. I think I entered the system at 14 and I didn't know what the process was like. I didn't know what it was like to go to court, and I didn't go to court until a while into being in the system. And so I think just knowing more about the process and then being more involved in general, I often didn't know my lawyers until I was at court. They would talk to me right before and not ask a lot of questions about me, just ask a lot of questions like, what are you looking for today? Like, sort of general things. But I think that relationship building would have empowered me to be more involved in the process, like I said, but also just speak to the judge or, you know, at least tell my lawyer what I needed to be communicated. I think ultimately I would have liked my lawyers to stand up for me a little bit more, but that would have meant that they needed to know a little bit more about me. So I think that would have been a really impactful thing for me, and to know that they're, you know, the last line of defense for me who was in the system as a child, who didn't know the process, who didn't know really what was going on or what rights I had. That would have all been really impactful for me.
And I think, Emilio, you shared in one of our interviews how important, I think it was your CASA maybe was to some of this. Could you talk about that? Yeah. Like they'd given a statement in court or something like that?
Yeah. So when I was in care, I was hoping to start hormone replacement therapy. And it was something that my mom was against. So I actually ended up going to court for the judge to decide. And one of the people who really stood up for me was my CASA, because she did do that work. She did, you know, see me at least monthly, and she really asked a lot of the questions. She was, like we talked about earlier, very curious, very just in it, you know? So that was really important for me. And she was someone who stood up in court and was like, I think this is the best, as long as the medical professionals are on the same page. And it ended up in me starting hormone replacement therapy. And it was one of the things that I really do think changed and saved my life in a lot of ways.
Thank you. I think that's, again, something that in theory, everyone realizes when you have a client, you need to get to know them. But in practice, as you experienced, a lot of lawyers just aren't. And I appreciate you highlighting that. And so just reminding everybody how critical it is that you begin with your client and really know who they are and what they need and what they want well in advance of the court hearing. So, Emilio, I appreciate you being willing to share that. I do want to highlight, and again, these we will put these in the show notes, but LGBTQ youth do face different challenges in the system, whether it's placements, services, you know, all sorts of issues require that you really, really know your client. And certainly there are many, many systemic problems out there. And so resources for lawyers on that, the ombudsman offices, which are in the report itself, there's always the ACLU and Lambda Legal who do a lot of work in this space as well. So I would encourage the lawyers out there, if you're hitting a wall in your local system, to access these other resources so that you can fight for your clients and what they need.
Yeah.
Elliot, there are a couple of other resources I wanted to ask you about. One is about the Trevor Project as another resource that lawyers could look to.
Yeah. So the Trevor Project does a really great job of hearing directly from young people and then putting out informational reports about what do young people tell us about how they're experiencing life in the world. And so there's a yearly mental health report that they do. So the most recent one being the 2024 National Report on LGBTQ Youth. And I think it's a great report to go to again and again to see what are the percentages of young people saying that they don't feel supported or what they needed. There's some great breakdowns in there of like what is most important to them from allies. And they talk about things like it's more important to feel seen and heard and talk to about who I am and ask what I need than to see like rainbow flags. That's great. But what I need more than I need a visual of you being a safe space is to experience that, those sort of things. So if you're not directly interfacing with LGBTQ youth or the Ruby just aren't ready to tell you everything they think yet, this can be one place to go to get more data and information that you could also cite if you needed to say like, young people are telling us this. They also just put out research reports in general. So that can be a great place. And then as a direct tool for young people you work with, they have some crisis support services around like hotline stuff. So if you're working with young people around suicide prevention or you're just worried, that could be a resource for young people that's free and national for young folks. So yeah.
That's excellent. And before we wrap up, I'd also love for you to talk about the article that you've written on allyship as well.
Yeah, so my company is called Unicorn Solutions. I'm a person with lived experience in care. I'm also a trans person. And so I wrote a piece on my Substack, so Unicorn Solutions Substack. And you can find that on my website, unicornsolutions.org. There's a little button at the top of the page to take you there. But I just had, as a trans person with lived experience, I'm 31, and so I've been doing some of this advocacy for a while and now supporting more young people doing this advocacy, was starting to feel the challenges of what does it mean to be a good ally but not speak for us or take over space for us? And that's something I have to challenge myself on all the time as I get older. But I was really noticing the field, so to speak, as in child welfare, research, academia, lifting up folks who are not trans, but to speak for us when there really is so many opportunities. And in 2024, I don't see any good excuse for not having connection to people with lived experience other than that we don't trust you and want to work with you. And so you can always do report writing in collaboration with us. You can present at conferences in collaboration with us. There's just so many ways that even beyond that, you can pay us to have full-time jobs or part-time jobs and internships. There's just so many ways to get creative with that. That I want people to really think about the challenge that allyship can sometimes morph into silencing, even when we think we're being helpful. I don't want allies to not say anything, because if there's anything we're going to need, especially now more than ever, is people to speak up. But to really balance, when am I speaking for? When am I putting myself and my privilege on the line as a defense so other people aren't in the line of fire? But when can I be an ally in all these ways and continue to be thoughtful so that I'm not speaking for folks when I could be letting them speak with me and giving them that platform. And I've had so many experiences of that, this report included, where people really trusted me as an equal partner, not as a token or as sort of this like asterisk on the side. And so that's a really great piece to read if you both want to understand how to try to think about allyship if you're trying to do that, but also to think about what are the challenges our communities are experiencing right now that we're sort of gearing up for nervously with the next administration change that you might want to keep in mind when you're working with your clients and sort of the risks or the challenges. And of course, I'm always happy for folks to reach out if you just have questions or want to sort of talk through what's going on and how to be a better support in all of this.
Thank you for being willing to do that. And we will link to that article as well for
Of
folks, because
course.
I think that would be really a great thing. Before we wrap up, Emilio, is there anything else you would like to add or any other message that you would want to put out to the lawyers out there?
Sure. I think, we've touched on all these topics, but really empowering and uplifting our voices and really being able to, make space for us in any way that we can, because many, many times as a youth in the system, there's no space made for you other than what's required. So I think that's super important. And like we mentioned, I think these next few years are going to be difficult, as particularly for trans and non-binary youth, and it's never been a better time to really fight like hell for us.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And I want to thank you both for all of the work that went into this resource. It is really a phenomenal report. I encourage all of our listeners to go on, check out the links that we'll have in the show notes, get through the report, and I think you'll learn a lot to enable you to fight. So I want to thank you both so much for being here.
Thank
Thank you.
you. Thank you.
And thanks everybody for listening.
You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.